From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the final segment in a series of discussions about literary biography. The topic of the following program is Willa Cather, the American novelist who lived from 1873 till 1947, a time of important transition in American literature. My guests are Margaret Ann O'Connor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona. Professor O'Connor's scholarship focuses on the correspondence and short stories of Willa Cather. Professor Terhorst recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book entitled The Fortunes of the Novel, a study in the transposition of a genre. The conversation begins with comments from Robert Terhorst about the extent to which Willa Cather's fiction draws upon the life of its author.
The usual response with respect to Cather to that question would be that she drew enormously on her own, especially early experience. On one occasion she commented, I forget to whom, that a novelist found his or her material mainly out of the first 16 years of life. And I think there's one can see a very ready transposition in Cather's fiction from her own life and from the lives of friends and acquaintances. But also, Cather worked up something which I think would just have to be called the religion of art, that this would have been pretty much standard doctrine in advanced artistic thinking in the time. Cather was well aware of European literary and artistic currents, and in some measure I think Cather did herself a disservice by appearing to draw so exclusively on life, when at the same time, and very early, there's a highly sophisticated awareness of the latest and prevailing modes in all the arts, in music, in literature, in painting. A wonderfully broad and deep knowledge of trends of her time in art. So she had a care for theory and a sensitivity to theory, which is unique, except for James.
I would have a different answer to the question that Bob just addressed, and that is, just what are we to make of the life of Cather that comes through her novels? Cather herself gives us an excuse, in one sense, for looking for her in her work. She was asked in a late interview if she planned to write an autobiography, and she said no. That she virtually had, that everything that was important to her, that was really part of her, was in her novels, and that it would almost be redundant to do an autobiography.
I understand that she wouldn't approve, for instance, of the kind of thing that you're doing now, talking about her and making of her life a publicizing it, in effect. Is that right?
That might be true. She loved to read biographies herself, and as most novels are, her novels are fictionalized biographies to some extent. A focus on a character or characters, a specific situation, and in her early work in particular, she dealt with an entire lifespan in one sense of trying to epitomize a person. So she had a biographical spirit in one sense.
Biographical, but not exclusively autobiographical. And also, one of the things that interested Cather was the span, the flow of time that encompassed a single life, its changes, its alternations, its degradations, its exaltations.
Let me ask you to comment on Cather's appeal to popular audiences. Why is she important to popular readers? Is she still important to popular readers today, Maggie?
Her novels have virtually been in print continuously from the day of their first publication. I think that she was a woman who saw herself as a career woman very early. As a professional, whether it was going to be a professional journalist, professional teacher, it would always involve also being an artist. But support would come from her own labors, from her own work. I think that there is usually a two-year gap between the publication of her works after she began writing her novels at the age of 40. And this is a big thing. I think she began writing her novels when she was already mature. And she wrote novels from 1912. Her last one was published in 1940. We have a career that spans one of the broadest periods that we have in American literature. I think that her themes are of interest to the general audience. I think that her characters are not black and white. Whenever we look at one of her very best characters, we can always see also some of their worst qualities shown. And even when we look at a villain, there's something underneath that is likable in the most despicable. There's something intriguing, there's something very human, there's something very full. She doesn't deal in just two-dimensional characters. That makes her popular to a general audience. Mm-hmm.
You say that she was a professional. Has Willa Cather been appropriated by the women's movement, by feminist theory today?
I think that Cather herself never saw herself as a feminist, consciously writing to improve the position of women. Mm-hmm. She was very dubious about any kind of social reformist movement. And I think even though she worked as the managing editor for McClure's for 6 years in New York, she really stayed away from those kinds of reformist spirits and certainly didn't want it to, quote, infect her work. She would have denied that she was a feminist herself. I think that feminists today are finding in Cather a voice that they might have overlooked earlier because it was so soft-spoken.
Mm-hmm.
What Cather has in her work is a conscious attempt not to be a male voice or a female uh-huh. voice. She got into a debate, as a matter of fact, with her mentor, Sarah Orne Jewett, about a short story that she had done. She'd written it in the mode of Henry James. She had a male narrator, really a male central consciousness, and he was in love with a character. And this is a story called On the Gull's Road that was never reprinted in Cather's lifetime. Sarah Orne Jewett said, "The story's fine, but I think it's always a mistake when a woman tries to sound like a man. You might as well just use your own female voice and forget trying to sound like a man." Cather.
Fatal advice for Cather, I think.
Well, Cather, that was in about 1908, mm-hmm. and Cather used the male voice with Jim Burden. And that was really the first time in her major mm-hmm. fiction that she tried to do that. I think what she tried to achieve in her work was the kind of androgyny mm-hmm. that would put the artist above the consciousness, the limiting consciousness of a point of view of either male or female. It was Coleridge who said, "All great minds are androgynous," thinking back on Shakespeare, a writer, an artist who could empathize with men and women, who had such a true sense of how they thought and saw one another, that his own maleness did not interfere with his rendering of their emotions and their sense of themselves. I think that's what Cather's goal was, and I think very often she achieves this by putting male and female characters together in
counterpoint and dialogue. In many ways, I think what Maggie is saying is that Cather is a post-feminist, in a sense that she somehow made an incredible leap and arrived all by herself at a state of being in which one's gender is neither advantage nor disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. In the 1930s, critics looked at Cather's work and said, "Here's a woman who has ignored our own problems, our own social concerns right now. This is not a writer for today. It's a writer for the older folks to look at, a writer who's nostalgic about a beautiful lost past."
A genteel writer.
And I think this criticism cut Cather to the quick, really. She was disappointed. She'd always met with great critical acclaim with her novels up until the 30s. And now, in the Depression years, it was the Steinbeck mind, the James T. Farrell.
Social relevance
that was important. Well, that dismissal by the group of liberal literary critics didn't just end with her death. I think it's something that even today still has to be fought.
I think Cather is a natural aristocrat, and that's something very hard. She's a very American writer, but it's something very hard for many American temperaments to come to terms with. I think this wonderful quality in her has been very hard for the critics to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can draw some of these threads together and talk about some specifics in her fiction. Maggie, let me ask you to comment on a favorite book or a book that you think would be appropriate to illustrate some of these artistic and intellectual concerns in Willa Cather. What would that be?
Probably her most popular books are O Pioneers, My Antonia, and Death Comes for the Archbishop.
Mm-hmm.
I think, however, that a book like The Professor's House of 1925 is a book that is unjustly ignored when the general reader thinks about looking at Willa Cather's work.
What goes on in this book? Why is it important?
I think the book is important biographically because both Willa Cather and Godfrey St. Peter are 51 years old when the book is taking place. Both of them have completed 8 volumes of their life work, and both are now in a transition phase. Godfrey St. Peter is in the phase of moving from one house to a new and more attractive house in the small college town he and his wife and 2 children have lived in for years. Willa Cather was in a more metaphorical phase of transition, one that had dealt up to this, her career up to this point had, in its best works, dealt with Nebraska and her life on the frontier. We know now that she was moving toward doing historical novels. Her next novel was going to be Death Comes for the Archbishop. She was looking at different places, different eras. This novel, I think, struck Cather very close to home. And I think that in this work, she identifies with a career man because her life is so much closer to the kinds of choices that Godfrey St. Peter had to make, for instance, than those that his wife Lillian had to make. She sees herself as the responsible head of her own life, and through Godfrey St. Peter, we can find out a lot about Cather and a lot about her era and her age and what the 1920s were like as well.
This novel points out also one extraordinary gift of Cather's as an American novelist. As far as I know, she is the only American novelist to have taken up convincingly in fiction all human presences in North America, Spanish, Canadian, Native American, European. And one thing that The Professor's House, which is an extraordinarily structured novel, is to bring into, the novel takes place in Michigan, is to bring in to this one geographical area all these presences. Godfrey St. Peter's 8 volumes have been entitled The Spanish Adventurers in North America.
This is what he's been doing
this
as a professor.
This is his magnum opus, mm-hmm. And which he's finished and for which he's won a prize. And the prize has enabled his wife to buy them a fancy new house, buy and build them a fancy new house. And then this novel, I think, is, as to form and structure, is a novel of genius, because it does remove all the props and tries to approach the spirit, and above all, the spirit of Godfrey St. Peter.
And what is that spirit, Maggie? Who is this man? Why is he important that we see him without what Bob Terhorst calls the props?
He's important because right now he is going through one of those passages.
What we now call midlife crisis, I believe.
Midlife crisis. And the woman who's writing of his life empathizes so strongly with his dilemma because of her own. And because of that inevitability at the beginning of the novel, the new house has already been moved into. The old house is empty. And he has made his decision now that he is going to stay as long as he possibly can with the old. He will stay above the empty house in the small little study with the inadequate heating, with all of the dangers that ultimately wind up.
Yeah, he has. It's very important to the novel that he has a gas stove which is leaky, and he has to prop the window open to keep from asphyxiating himself. That's important to the novel.
So there is a sense of kind of danger almost. It's almost humorous. It would be carelessness. But there's a sense of danger even, and discomfort certainly with his staying in this old house. But this is where he accomplished so much, and he is very, very reluctant to leave. So we have a sense, I would think, that any reader would come to that book, particularly someone who themselves have had to face that kind of ultimate thing, the idea that if they're going to live, they're going to have to move to that newer house. They cannot stay where they are, not
indefinitely. Is this a part of Cather's ongoing sort of transitional kind of fiction, the move
Very
from Virginia
much.
To Nebraska, and the fact that you can't have stasis?
You can't. Life is change.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of this book, as admirable, as successful, as handsome, as
distinguished,
idealized as the professor is, he is reluctant to leave the past behind and move into something new. Here is a novel about someone who is having a block. What is the next great project? Is it all over? Is this the end? It's a theme that haunts Hemingway. It's a theme that we can find so often in the works of other writers of Cather's generation, writers of the generation she was publishing in, but remember also that they were writers who were a generation younger than she.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion about the life and work of Willa Cather, the American novelist. My guests are Margaret Ann O'Connor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona. The conversation resumes with special attention to Willa Cather's 1925 novel, The Professor's House.
Maggie, let me ask you to read from a passage here in The Professor's House and tell me why it's important in this book.
The passage I'd like to read is from the first of the three sections of the book called The Family. And in it, the professor has left his old house and has walked back to the new grand house that his wife Lillian has outfitted for the two of them. I think the passage is important not only for what it shows about Godfrey St. Peter and the way that he visualizes the world, but I think it's also the way that Willa Cather saw art in relation to nature and pulled the two together. The professor happened to come home earlier than usual one bright October afternoon. He left the walk and cut across the turf, intending to enter by the open French window, but he paused a moment outside to admire the scene within. The drawing room was full of autumn flowers, dahlias and wild asters and goldenrod. The red-gold sunlight lay in bright puddles on the thick blue carpet, made hazy aureoles about the stuffed blue chairs. There was, in the room, as he looked through the window, a rich, intense effect of autumn, something that presented October much more sharply and sweetly to him than the colored maples and the aster-bordered paths by which he had come home. It struck him that the seasons sometimes gain by being brought into the house, just as they gain by being brought into painting and into poetry. The hand, fastidious and bold, which selected and placed, it was that which made the difference. In nature, there is no selection. The passage is particularly pertinent to an appreciation of the novel because of the way, number one, that the image of the house is used. Professor St. Peter comes to the new house and looks through the window. He is an outsider. He looks through the French window and sees a prepared scene inside. The colors of the flowers, the contrast between the created atmosphere inside and an atmosphere that some other observers might say is just as created outside, by a God, a powerful force, but God-free, St. Peter, doesn't recognize that sense of order on that outside world. What we see here is an appreciation for the touch of the human being, the accomplishment of man, the builder, in this case, the ability of St. Peter's wife, Lillian, to create autumn inside the house, even better than a god had created autumn in the outside world. It suggests that here is a man whose ultimate appreciation is for a sense of order, a sense of that kind of integrity.
Another consonance that we find in this description is also that what Godfrey St. Peter appreciates on the domestic scene also characterizes his own work. His art is that of the narrative, and as a historical narrator, he necessarily chooses, selects, emphasizes. So St. Peter's craft as a historian is similar to the taste which his wife has shown in arraying natural things like flowers in an artful way. On the landscape of human history, in the Spanish adventurers, Godfrey St. Peter has done the same thing. And Cather here is doing something which I consider rather brilliant, and that is studying in a novel where time seems to have stopped, at least for St. Peter, the whole nature of narration. And of course, the selectivity is fundamental to it. So we see the artist as historian and the historian as artist at the same time, reaching a kind of degree, zero degree, where you've reached stasis, you've stopped, the whole thing comes to a halt. Another vital structure in the novel is the pueblo, which Tom and his friend discover. And this is, I mean, those of us who know the Southwest know how, even now, how wonderfully crystalline and pure and pristine it is, how positive its negatives are, how silence there is something unlike silence, let us say, in the East. And there is a kind of living death experience which Tom goes through when he discovers this dead pueblo. They speculate on what's happened to the inhabitants of the pueblo. It seems to have been cut off in mid-career, rather like Tom himself. They do find a few mummies, who apparently were old people, who may have been buried just before all the inhabitants left. But it is a dead, but beautifully preserved, crystalline, pristine structure. And out there, Tom Outland has a gift for solitude, which is most extraordinary. And he spends some 6 months out there on the mesa in the pueblo that he and his friend have discovered, reading Virgil. He's prepping himself for college, and of course then you had to get your Latin up. But they're working, it's reading a dead language in a dead pueblo. Brush with the absolute, with death, and the way the novel brings death right to the center of the novel in the figure of Tom Outland is one of its brilliant, extraordinary features.
We could look at so many good reasons for Tom Outland to be in this book. It's intriguing, however, to remember, first of all, that the critics were almost universally appalled at the structure of the professor's house. What a pity, they said, that such a beautifully involving story of Professor St. Peter was cut in half by this first-person narrative. Professor St. Peter sits down and reads this diary left by his dead student. And that, as far as the early critics were concerned, interrupted the structure of the novel. It just broke the novel up completely. Today we look at it and we have a sense of the fresh air that was let into the novel by this movement from Hamilton, Michigan, to a pueblo in New Mexico. And Cather used that image in a justification for the structure of the novel that had been insulted in a letter to the Saturday Review of Literature. her critical reputation is really on the rise, perhaps because of new interest from feminist readers. Also, I think because of attention from critics who were turned off by the negative criticism that she received from the critics of the 1930s. So she's being discovered by a new group of critics.
I think in many ways, now that crude realism, the taste for crude realism has passed, that we're much more open to the varieties of fiction, and that Cather will be more read, better appreciated, and much better criticized.
So many readers have looked at the last couple of pages in The Professor's House and seen it as a profoundly depressive book. She ends the book suggesting that Godfrey St. Peter has had a brush with death in his little garret room, that he fell asleep as the gas jet came on and was saved by the fortuitous arrival of the seamstress who had been sharing his little study in earlier years. She is a simple woman with a simple Roman Catholic faith, and it is she who winds up saving him, literally, because he would have died if she hadn't arrived. The book ends with these few observations. All the afternoon he sat there at the table where now Augusta was reading, thinking over his life, trying to see where he'd made his mistake. Perhaps the mistake was merely in an attitude of mind. He'd never learned to live without delight, and he would have to learn to, just as in a prohibition country he supposed he would have to learn to live without sherry. Theoretically, he knew that life is possible, maybe even pleasant, without joy, without passionate griefs, but it had never occurred to him that he might have to live like that. Well, those are depressing words. I mean, if we assume that this book says that by the end, Geoffrey St. Peter has learned to live without delight.
And especially without sherry.
that this is the conclusion, I think that we would have to agree that it doesn't offer comfort in the world of 1925 that St. Peter has to adapt to. But I do believe that what this book primarily does is suggest that he is a survivor, that he can find the new projects, that he has to make a commitment to life itself and accept change, even if he can't relish the new world that he finds himself in.
The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. My guests were Margaret Ann O'Connor of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona. The topics were the life and work of Willa Cather, the American novelist. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the concluding segment in the Soundings series on literary biography. The topics will be the life and work of Willa Cather, the American novelist. My guests are Margaret Ann O'Connor of the University of North Carolina and Robert Terhorst of the University of Arizona. Margaret O'Connor specializes in the correspondence and short stories of Willa Cather. Robert Terhorst recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book entitled The Fortunes of the Novel. A discussion of literary biography and Willa Cather, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.